From the International Association of Marriage and Family Counselors, I'm Robert Caceres, and this is The Reframe. Today's guest is Dr. Jason King. Dr. King currently works as the Student Development Coordinator for the Department of Counseling at Walden University. He has extensive experience treating addiction and working with couples and families, and he spoke with me about his positive approaches to receiving harsh feedback from clients.
But he said, if I'm going to work with you, then I need to tell you a few things that you need to do. Because you suck as a therapist. And I said, okay, I'm all ears. I said, on a scale of 0 to 10, with 10 being the worst, absolute suck the worst, what can I do to go from a 10 to a 9.5 on the suckometer scale? And he kind of chuckled. And I reflected again of genuinely, what tips or advice do you have for me? He gave me some parameters and some guidelines, and I said, as long as I can just suck a little bit less by the time we're done, then I'm going to feel good about our work together. What do you think? And he was comfortable, and he agreed. I felt that it was important to honor his autonomy. I have found that ethical principle is really essential to melting client resistance and helping them feel empowered.
Welcome to The Reframe. Over the next hour, you'll hear Dr. King highlight strategies for working with challenging and resistant clients, describe the various ways that he incorporates humor into his clinical work, and discuss systemic approaches to using the DSM. Dr. King also explains the clinical benefits of exhibiting genuineness and humility.
You just meet your client where they're at and just be yourself and don't try to be a rock star or a gymnast when it comes to all these techniques and stuff and trying to impress them. Just be human. Clients just want to know that you're human too.
Jason began our conversation by describing how his childhood experiences led him to consider a career in family counseling.
My path to becoming a counselor really has a lot of its origins back in, from what I can recall, probably pre-adolescence, before adolescence. I noticed that I had a lot of compassion or empathy for other people. Like, for example, if someone was hurt physically, it's like I would feel their pain. It's like my body would almost like feel something. And I think that kind of turned into, over the years, when I got into high school, friends or other students that I was around, they would just like come to me and just share their problems or concerns at school, or we would talk on the phone, and I would listen and I would give them advice. And I guess my parents overheard me on some phone conversations. And I remember my mom saying, wow, you just sound really like natural helping, you know, your friends. Have you ever thought of becoming a counselor? And I was like, no, that's never crossed my mind. But that comment and some others just made me kind of start thinking about that. That really didn't sink in a lot until I really began college, and I didn't have much interest in, like, you know, business or marketing, and those kind of popular degrees. I went towards the parenting classes. I went towards the human development classes, and I loved them. They were just exciting, and I loved just learning about lifespan development, child and adolescent development, and then adult development, and separate courses, really breaking down the whole lifespan development thing. And I just got immersed in really a lot of human development concepts in college, and I wasn't sure what my degree was going to be in when I started. I knew what I didn't want to do. Part of that was like business and marketing. On a side note, which is interesting because then I started my own counseling business many years later. But the courses didn't seem exciting to me. And what really connected and resonated with me was the descriptions for the courses that were related to human development. And more so than psychology-based particular courses. That ended up being my minor, with my major being human development and family studies. I loved learning about family systems, and a course in my undergrad that really got me thinking about the whole counseling thing again was I took a Basics of Family Therapy course as an undergrad. It was a rare course that was offered during the summer from the professor, and it sounded exciting, and wow, learning about seeing Satir in action in videos and Salvador Minuchin, it just lit a fire in me and just brought together a lot of the human development concepts that I had been reading and studying and writing about and taking tests about. And it gave me something that brought all this to life and made it tangible for me. And I started thinking, I want to become a marriage and family therapist. Like, this is what I finally knew. Here I am, like a senior in my undergrad, my bachelor's program, and I finally knew what I wanted to become. And that was an exciting time in my life to finally get some direction about this is kind of where I want to go, what I want to do. And I happened to be working at a place where a friend of mine introduced me to a master's in mental health counseling program. And as he explained how it worked and so forth, it just seemed like a great fit for me. And so we started that program together, and from day one, that just continued the fire that was lit in me about wanting to work with couples, families, even individuals. And from there, I was a sponge and just soak up all the coursework and the interaction with the faculty. It was a KCREP mental health counseling degree program, so it was rigorous, but I loved it. I welcomed the work and the application of all that I'd been learning, even from undergrad, was now really coming to life. And that just got me excited. I just loved it.
Well, what were some of those things you initially learned that you were just like, yeah, this resonates with me, this really clicks, I can't wait to do this approach or implement this technique?
Yeah, you know, I think some of those, ironically enough, was reframing. To me, reframing seemed like a really cool trick that counselors would use. And I was introduced to that in my Basics of Family Therapy course. And it just seemed like something simple, but it was powerful in what it could offer. Another part that kind of got really, I think, exciting was just being able to know that I could help people, especially with like resolving conflict. Because I've always wanted to have like peace in relationships. And I saw counseling as a way to bring peace and to bring healing when there's been conflict between couples or between parents and a child. And when I learned about different types of communication strategies for conflict resolution, I got excited. It's like I had some tangible skills, things that I could use to actually kind of reach like goals and things that I've always kind of wanted to accomplish professionally. Those are two things that really stand out that I got excited about when I was learning about family therapy and more just human development principles.
Well, tell me more about how human development has informed your various approaches to working with different ages and populations.
Yeah. That's really been foundational for me, and I have no regrets, you know, focusing on human development. I feel that it gives me a context and a perspective that psychology sometimes can miss. And it's the context of relationships, and it's the context of developmental, you know, milestones and progression and the whole idea of growth. And that we all need nurturing individually and relationally. And that's what facilitates that human development, is to have relationships that provide growth, nourishment, and a positive, you know, supportive environment. And then we thrive. And so I got excited when I learned about Carl Rogers and humanistic counseling and his theories, because that really just tapped right into the human development that there's positivity in humankind, and it's all about growth and developing and reaching our full potential. So for me, I've always tried to look at my clients from a developmental perspective and not try to impose on them goals and counseling or outcomes that would be developmentally unobtainable. I've tried to always think about what is obtainable with this client, given their stage of development, the resources they have, their current level of motivation, what's obtainable for them instead of what is altruistic and even what I think would be best for them. But it's how can I help them help themselves to get unstuck and to remove some of the obstacles that are in front of them, and even at times obstacles because of choices they've made that are is blocking their development, their progression, either individually or relationally, if they're in some kind of committed or marriage relationship, or they have children, it's a family relationship, and they're stuck. And so it's really helped me always see the positive and the strengths in my clients and to tap into those and to build upon those and to have a balanced approach when I'm looking at problems or, you know, for example, you know, disorders or, you know, pathology, and to look at the individual collectively from a developmental perspective, and that they have a lot of positivity to bring to the counseling relationship and to their own healing and growth that they can achieve.
You cited Rogers as a foundational reference, and you acknowledged, you know, very eloquently how you strive so diligently to be congruent and to demonstrate that unconditional positive regard and to be non-judgmental. Are there other ways that you express kind of yourself and your personality and your way of being that you feel like also nurtures that therapeutic alliance and strengthens that bond?
I think part of that is I bring in humor into counseling, and I try to make it be appropriate and the right timing. And I found that helps to create an environment of comfort for clients, that therapy is not this stale, like rigid, kind of stoic process. It's not always serious. It gets very serious because we're addressing and talking about very critical and important life issues or developmental milestones. But that needs to be balanced with some appropriate humor so that clients can just feel like, okay, my therapist is human too. And not just this robot who is, you know, spitting out information or is just passively listening, but really engaged in understanding. And so I found that humor appropriately used has been very helpful to break the ice with clients and to build a relationship with them, help them feel safe and comfortable, let their defenses down. And part of that too is that I've even kind of made fun of myself, acknowledged my own mistakes or errors that I've made, and apologized to clients. And that's gone a long way.
Well, give me an example of a time where you just look back on ways you've implemented humor and you're like, oh, that's unforgettable. I'll never forget that time. Or a way maybe that you were self-deprecating and you feel like, oh, wow, that just made a world of difference.
There's really one profound situation that happened when I was doing family therapy. And it began with working with an adolescent who was referred by the court system for some truancy and some theft that happened at school. And so he was court ordered to participate in 12 family therapy sessions with me. And when we had the first counseling session, both parents attended. And it was a rough, difficult first session of reducing the negativity, the blame, developing a good alliance. The second session, the father did not come back, and the mother reported that she had kicked him out of the house because of some conflict, and this had been ongoing. It wasn't like it just started, you know, during the week, but it had reached a point of culmination where need to separate for a time. So we continued finishing off the sessions. It was about maybe 4 or 5 months later that this adolescent ended up engaging in some theft again at school. He took a kid's iPod out of his locker. And apparently, when the adolescent went to court, father was there and was overheard in comments that seemed supportive and almost just justifying what his son had did, that kind of no big deal. And apparently dad had some of his own history of some criminal conduct too. So the judge was aware that dad was basically enabling and reinforcing this behavior and wasn't really disciplining his son. So the judge ordered the dad to do 6 sessions of family therapy with me and his son. He was not happy. So when we started off the session, he was an older gentleman. He was disabled and he walked with a cane. And we had a little room off to the side of the in the courthouse, off to the side of the courtroom where I would meet with these families that were ordered by the judge for therapy. And as we began this first of 6 sessions with the adolescent and his father, the father, he sits down pretty quickly and with force in his chair. He takes his cane and he gently kind of slaps it on the table. And he looks at me and he points at me and he says, "First thing is you need to know you're the worst therapist ever. You suck." And that's how the session began. I had a lot of things going through my mind in a split second of how to respond. You know, one of those was, well, I can tell this gentleman all the accomplishments I've achieved professionally, you know, some awards and certifications and other recognitions and thing about why I'm such a good therapist. And this is maybe, 2 years into my counseling career. But then I realized that's not going to work. Or I could just directly just refute him and say, you know, you can't blame me for your problems or whatnot. And I realized that's not going to work. And what I defaulted on was my counseling training of using counseling theories to guide my decision-making. And so some of the training that I had received was a lot of, motivational interviewing, meeting clients where they're at, and doing a lot of reframing about negativity and problems. And so I put on my Carl Rogers hat, and I genuinely thanked him. I said, "Thank you for telling me up front how you feel about me. That helps me to know, because I don't want you to go through these counseling sessions and you don't feel like you can tell me how you feel about me." And I asked him, "Help me understand why I'm so terrible as a counselor." And he said, "It's your fault that my wife kicked me out of the house. So now I'm being blamed for a marital situation." And again, I had some options of I can get defensive, but that wasn't going to do anything. So I just rolled with the resistance. I just went along and I said, "Wow, I didn't realize I was that powerful as a counselor." And validating him and reflecting back in a way that, well, I wanted him to think about what you're telling me. I'm responsible for the breakup of your marriage? Wow. And he was kind of like, "Well, no, it's not really, really all your fault, but it's kind of your fault that my son doesn't like me and we don't get along. And cause you didn't fix things. You didn't fix my wife when you worked with her and my son, and you didn't fix my son and our relationship." And I said, "I'm sorry, but I'm glad that you and I can be together so that you can teach me how to do that. And hopefully I'll finally get that right this time." And that's where I just felt like I needed to validate him. Also bring in a little bit of some humor of, and some genuineness too of, "I want to work with you and you seem to be the expert here. So teach me." And he still was very resistant to working with me. And I just said, hey, you don't have to want to work with me, but you do have a dilemma. The judge has court ordered you to 6 sessions. So you and I have to spend 6 50-minute meetings together. Would you rather do that or have to deal with maybe probably going to jail for violating the court order? Which is the lesser, like, two evils for you? And he commented, working with me. But he said, if I'm going to work with you, then I need to tell you a few things that you need to do, because you suck as a therapist. And I said, okay, I'm all ears. I said, on a scale of 0 to 10, with 10 being the worst, absolute suck the worst, what can I do to go from a 10 to a 9.5 on the suckometer scale? And he kind of chuckled. And I reflected again of genuinely, what tips or advice do you have for me? And in the interest of time, I won't get into all that he shared, but he did, he gave me some parameters and some guidelines. And I said, as long as I can just suck a little bit less by the time we're done, then I'm going to feel good about our work together. What do you think? And he was comfortable and he agreed. He was still hesitant after that session, but he would come in the next, came in the next session, and he was less, you know, he was more motivated, more engaged, participatory. And we got to a point after the third session where it was time for me to implement what he had told me to do to make me more effective and to work. And I asked for his permission. Is it okay for me to do the things that you told me I need to do to suck less? Because I see an opportunity right here, right now. Do I have your permission to do that? I felt that it was important to honor his autonomy, which is an important ethical principle, and not just me jump in and say, okay, here's what we got to do. Hold on a second. I'm seeing an opportunity for me to practice and implement what you told me to do so that this is a less worse experience for you. Not a better, because he wasn't ready to go there to think that it's better, but just that it was less worse. And respecting his autonomy, I have found that ethical principle is really essential to melting client resistance and helping them feel empowered. And that just changed the whole direction of that session. I was able to confront him directly in the manner that he told me to do it, and he took it. And he really took it in, and he went home and he made the change.
That's a really striking illustration, because it represents a 180 from your initial instinct of how you wanted to respond. Of like, you know, let me give you the litany of my credentials and my expertise and the reasons why I don't suck and how awesome I am.
Let me tell you all the other families I've worked with and have helped over the years. That wouldn't have done anything.
Yeah, and I remember thinking too as a student, like, oh, you know, I can't wait until, you know, I have a doctorate or I'm fully licensed, or, you know, then I'll feel like I've earned a sense of competence in the eyes of my clients. And yet, like, my clients don't seem to be too fazed by any of that. It's about the relationship, as you acknowledge, about that ability to respect autonomy and to be humble, to take pointed feedback and to be receptive and even cooperative. And the way you describe it, it reflects such tremendous humility, but also a sense of self-assuredness. And I'm wondering how both of those qualities, humility and maybe some self-confidence, have helped you throughout your career.
Yeah, that's two great essential ingredients to, I think, effective counseling. And, you know, I think I owe a lot of that to my supervisor, who initially trained me during my internship, and then even post-graduation. That learning that genuine humility, and really for me, it was embodying Carl Rogers, because I just think that he's just such a great personification of just genuineness and humility and just authenticity. So listening to him from conferences has been very transformational for me, to hear just how he communicates, how he answers questions, And then how he conceptualizes clients, I think, has helped me with the humility. And then counseling theories, especially I think motivational interviewing, has helped with the humility aspect of that. You just meet your client where they're at and just be yourself and don't try to be a rock star or a gymnast when it comes to all these techniques and stuff and trying to impressing them. Just be human. Clients just want to know that you're human too. And then the other part as far as I think the self-confidence, I would owe a lot to my supervisor as well in helping me to look to my clients for guidance and direction about what's working and what's not working, but also to separate that my ego, my self-worth can't be hanging on my clients and what they think about me. And I had to learn how to work through initial treatment failures in my early career and to not personalize those, but at the same time to reflect upon them to see what I could have done differently. But respecting client autonomy, the clients have a choice. And if a client dropped out of counseling or they relapsed on substance use while they've been in counseling with me, it doesn't automatically mean that I'm failing them as a counselor. Because they have their own autonomy. There can be some things that I could probably learn from that. There might be some things I've missed out on that might have impacted the client differently. But I've had to learn to separate myself from clients in that my identity and my sense of self-confidence needs to be independent of my clients. But this is delicate though, Rob, because at the same time, I look to counseling for personal and professional fulfillment. Because inherently, I love helping individuals. So if I'm also getting feedback from clients too about how we're working together, but I try to keep that collaborative approach. And I've had to learn to work on myself and in supervision to have a balanced approach with I can receive personal and professional fulfillment in counseling and working with my clients, but I can't hang my whole sense of self-worth on them. Especially when I've had clients who've attacked me in numerous ways as far as that, you know, I'm ineffective or I don't know what I'm talking about or because I didn't know an answer to something and wanted to look it up in a book, then that meant I was incompetent. You know, there's a variety of personal attacks I've received from clients and I've had to just embrace those and not let them personally affect me. But to in a sense, kind of reframe them as these are kind of unhealed wounds for my client from other relationships in their life. And something's going on between me and them that is reminding them of that. And for them, it's real. For them, it's genuine. And I need to honor and respect that and to try to understand it and explore it more, but not to get reactive to it.
But those are very pointed critiques, and I would imagine sometimes they can still sting a little. Does it ever hurt initially to receive those?
I know it did in my beginning years because I was excited to do counseling, but I also was very insecure. Like, am I doing it right? Am I effective? And am I giving my clients what they deserve? You know, I think for the initial, you know, I would say maybe 2.5 years, There was a lot of times where I just was insecure and I felt inadequate despite all the training that I had. But I wanted to keep going with it. I wanted to keep learning and growing. And so I've allowed myself to be impacted by my clients to teach me to be less judgmental, teach me to be more accepting, more understanding, more patient. And to ask questions, to genuinely enter into their world and to hear their story. And so, yeah, some statements and things from clients have stung, and I would say more so in my early years when my confidence wasn't as strong. I've also have to learn to let myself be impacted by my clients, like I mentioned, and how they've kind of transformed the way I think or the way I act, the way I perceive humans and human nature and how people change. It's been a fun journey being a counselor. It's nothing what I ever thought it would be, but at the same time, it's everything that I've wanted it to be.
Well, you've been very intentional about doing that hard work and that difficult process of self-reflection. What were some of those strategies from that initial phase where maybe things were a bit more painful to where you are now with that sense of resiliency and a stronger sense of professional identity and competency? How were you able to kind of bridge that gap?
I think, again, initially it was, you know, having some open, candid discussions with my supervisor. I had a good relationship with him. And I knew that I could share my insecurities and inadequacies in a manner that would be received as non-critical, non-judgmental. But it would still be educational for me and a learning opportunity for me. And my supervisor pointing out at times a parallel process of me acting out the way my clients were towards him. And when he would point that out, it actually to me was like fascinating, like, really? You're right. I am doing that. Oh my goodness. I thought it was cool when he would point out parallel process. I didn't take it as like, oh my gosh, I failed. I'm terrible. I'm never going to be a good counselor. It was like, wow, that's fascinating. And so I owe a lot to my supervisor. And then I think secondly is I've had friends and colleagues that I can talk with and consult with, share intense, difficult counseling experiences, and consult also in very, very rocky ethical dilemmas. And their listening ear and their support and their advice has strengthened, I think, my confidence and helped me, you know, learn how to practice humility with clients and to be genuine with them, but at the same time, developing a confidence that I can be effective clinically, that I have something to offer to my clients. But I still have to learn from each one of my clients and have a balanced approach with that. Other kind of supports for me have been the literature and reading publications that give me a framework to kind of understand things and techniques and skills to just help with that confidence level, but also with that. The humility is that I'm always learning. There's always something to learn. No matter how many books or journal articles I've read, I've just come to accept that there's always something to learn as a counselor, especially for my clients. And that's what's exciting about the profession.
Well, you've spoken so thoughtfully and heartfelt about the dispositions and the mindsets that, you know, you exhibit or you're striving for. And it sounds like that's allowed you to be such an effective clinician. I'm also curious about the various approaches or theoretical orientations that you've experienced great success in implementing.
Well, I'd have to say that a lot of it is the humanistic Carl Rogers. I have so many defined memories, positive memories with clients where, because of my persistence with reflecting feelings and reflecting content, and striving for deep, accurate empathy, my most memorable times in counseling are clients telling me, you're the first person that understands me. You're the first person that knows what I'm going through. How did you know I was thinking that? Can you read my mind? These are like pivotal moments of like, wow, Carl Rogers really nailed it on the head, that reflection and really striving for deep empathy is powerful therapeutically for clients. Because once my clients have told me those kinds of things, that's when therapy really takes off. And they just feel free to open up and they want to change. And they'll start asking like, so what do I need to do to change or to get rid of this problem? That's when they feel empowered, is when there's that deep, accurate, empathic connection. So person-centered theory has really been pivotal to my, what I attribute to my counseling success and enjoyment. Because it's like you mentioned earlier, my clients, they don't ask me what my GPA was in graduate school. They don't ask me what my favorite class was. They want to know that I understand them, I hear them, and that I accept them without judgment so they can feel safe to be themselves with me. So a lot of humanistic, which then gets into, like I mentioned, motivational interviewing, because I've done a lot of work with individuals with addictive compulsive behaviors and a lot of substance use. And motivational interviewing has just been phenomenal. It's been fun. It's been very informative for me because it's given me a framework about what to do, what not to do, when to do it, and how and why. It's given me a lot of intentionality in counseling. And I've seen it work when clients have been stuck, clients are resistant, clients are unmotivated. It's always worked for me. And then I would say that as far as other theories would be a lot of relational systemic theories, structural, strategic family therapy concepts have been very informative and helpful for me. And it depending on the client and their needs, I do draw upon then other counseling theories as I feel are appropriate. And I've really tried to have that foundation in the person-centered, which for me, it means that I need to adapt my clinical approach to the developmental stage of my client and where they're at emotionally, spiritually, mentally, and physically, and then draw upon appropriate counseling theories throughout the counseling process to match the client with what they need. And so I've learned and become very comfortable with not being locked into, I'm just this model or just this theoretical approach. Outside of my foundation that I've explained, being person-centered, from there, I really try to draw upon the multitude of counseling theories to guide what I do with clients.
What are some of those fundamental or practical considerations that you process and work through to determine the suitability of any one of those numbers of, you know, time-tested theories?
I look at, for example, a client cognitively, developmentally, is cognitive therapy going to be appropriate? Can they really engage in the appropriate cognitive disputation? Do they operate and from more of a thinking perspective or more from an emotion perspective? And so they might need a more emotion-focused approach, or some might need a more cognitive approach, whereas some might need a more behavioral approach because of the way that they function, the way that they interpret the world, and the way that they also can understand where I'm coming from. Or if clients are in, say they have a real struggle of letting go of a substance, there's times when attachment theories really helped me understand why this client will not let go of heroin. Because it symbolizes a secure attachment for them. It provides comfort. It provides a sense of meaning. And it's reliable. And it doesn't reject them. And so I can understand now why they struggle giving up heroin, for example. So I really try to look at where the client's at developmentally and also contextually. All of my clients are in relationships. And so in my counseling, I typically do sprinkle in some relational aspects and help my clients see how they're perceiving their relationships, how their behavior is impacting their relationships, and vice versa. And so I do sprinkle a lot of relational concepts. And talking to my clients in ways that keeps them relationally focused and not like isolated, as in it's just we're talking about like you and what you do. You're always in a relationship, friends, family, colleagues, employers, whatever it is, we're always in relationships. And so I'm always trying to understand their relationship satisfaction, relationship conflict, and then address those areas as needed.
I'd love to talk about the challenge and complex nature of couples counseling and that type of relationship. You said that, you know, you're very intentional and thoughtful about the modality that you use based on whether someone's more of a thinking person or a feeling person. And I would say pretty frequently in my own clinical work, I encounter couples where one person is very thinking and their partner is very feeling. And yet we work with the couple and not with the individuals. How do you navigate that unique and challenging dynamic?
Yeah, that's what I kind of love about it, is it is a challenging dynamic and I welcome that challenge. And so this is where reframing as a skill and technique has been very helpful when I'm doing relational work, especially when someone's communicating from a cognitive level and the recipient it understands more from an affective level. And so I use reframing to help buffer the blow of, but that's not what I want to hear from you, or I don't understand what you're talking about when you say that. If they may be on a feeling level more than, say, a cognitive level. And so as I use reflective listening to really try to understand my clients, it helps me then to reframe that, for example, when you might be telling your partner something that they're doing that you don't like, and you have all these rational reasons for it, it sounds to me like, you know, he or she doesn't hear what you're saying. What they feel is criticized. Is that what you're feeling? And either I check in with the partner or they've already kind of expressed that, well, I feel hurt, you know, because I feel criticized, I feel shamed, or I'm feeling rejected. So I developed this reframe of, so when you are sharing concerns to your partner, you have all these logical reasons that make it valid. Those get lost, though, in all that you say, and what your partner feels is criticized or rejected. And then you get upset because they shut down. But their shutting down is a way to protect themselves emotionally, because they just felt criticized and kind of rejected, and they don't know what to do. So I try to reframe both partners in their responses so they can both understand differently but have some empathy. And then it opens up then the opportunity for us is to find a way for you to make requests from your partner in a way that don't come across so cognitively criticizing, but that might have an element of some feeling attached to that, so that he or she doesn't feel criticized and rejected and remains open to your invitation or request that something changes in the relationship. So I try to make it be that we're together in all of this. Let's make it a win-win for both of you. And it helps to diffuse the sense of negativity and blaming and conflict between clients. The reframe is, I found, a very essential and a powerful technique in any relational work, because what I've learned from my clients is that relationship conflict, it always happens for multiple reasons, but a common denominator is that there's the miscommunication and the misunderstanding, and that individuals feel certain, you know, emotions when they hear or see certain behaviors or hear certain words, and then they react or they interpret the message differently than what the other person was intending for them to receive. And it's helping them learn to communicate in ways that the person that you're in a relationship with, you need to communicate their language to an extent. And reframing helps them do that.
Well, there's another language I'm curious about, and that's the language of diagnosis. I know that's one of the main areas of your expertise. And yet, I think from a counseling perspective, sometimes, unfortunately, it can get diminished, or there might be some confusion around whether or not the medical model is compatible with the wellness model or how to effectively and ethically integrate that. So I would just love to hear about kind of your experiences with developing your understanding of diagnosis and assessment, but also as you've written about in your book, from a systemic perspective.
Yeah, your question causes me to remember a powerful learning experience that I had early in my counseling career. I was working with an adolescent male. I think he was age 10 or 11, was in foster care. And I identified, you know, symptoms of ADHD, and the social work caseworker was also reporting this child probably has ADHD. So I do all my diagnostic assessment testing individually with my client, and then getting reports from the foster parent and the biological parent, and then also reports from the school teachers. And then I put all this together, and I did found evidence for ADHD. And as I sat down in a session with this child and his mother, and I'm sharing the results of the testing, she did not want to hear that. She insisted her son did not have ADHD. And here is a moment of where I was being schooled by my client, because in my pride, I get the DSM and I open up the DSM-4 TR and we look at ADHD and I get the testing and I line up all the symptoms and I show that all of this really clearly shows your son has ADHD. That didn't work. She got more defensive and more angry towards me. And so I'm feeling like personally attacked and like belittled, and I don't have any credibility because here I am like, I've put together all this assessment data. Why won't she believe me, you know? And I finally got it, or I mean, I had to step back because I was missing something. Because I was now stuck in a trap of arguing with my client, which is, that's a dead end road. I've learned. Never argue with a client. They will always win because they can always just fire me, you know? So I realized I had to change what I was doing. I took a step back and I said, okay, let's just pretend that your son has ADHD. I'm going to go with you that he doesn't, okay? Can you entertain me for just a moment? Let's just pretend he does have ADHD. What would that mean to you? She paused, and there was a moment of silence for maybe 10 seconds. And then she broke down crying, and she said, that would mean I failed as a mother. Wow. The feeling in my office in the room was immense, and I finally was starting to understand because I had slowed down and asked and got out of the whole diagnostic pathology label and getting her to accept it. And really understanding her, she personalized this as a parenting failure. It's her fault that her son acts this way. So I understand completely now why she's insisting he does not have ADHD, so that she can feel good about herself. Her son was just taken out of her custody. I have no idea how devastating that was to her. I could never know what that's like, because that's her experience. But I got a glimpse of it, because she felt very inadequate and insecure as a mother, and that if my kid has all these problems, it's my fault. When I stepped back diagnostically and stopped, you know, forcing the medical model and getting her to accept it, and I went back to what would this mean? Communication, Carl Rogers helped me understand that was powerful and transformational for me. Then I was able to have a discussion with her and to understand more where she was coming from and why. That changed the way I approached diagnosis, that the label isn't as important. The label really doesn't matter as much as what's important is that there are symptoms that are typically behaviors that most people are in agreement on that we need to address. And this mother was more than comfortable with us addressing specific impulsivity and inattentiveness behaviors than about, we're going to work on ADHD, and here's the medication for ADHD, and here's the treatment for ADHD. It's, my son will do things that risk his harm without even thinking. And we don't have to call it impulsivity. We can just call it that. You get scared when your son just does crazy things. Physical things, like off the wall kind of stuff. It scares you as a mom that he's going to get hurt. And you don't want that. She's comfortable talking that language. But the moment I say, well, we need to address your son's impulsivity that's part of his combined type of ADHD, she would shut down. So I've had to learn when it comes to diagnosis that I have to not only conceptualize my clients like diagnostically from a lifespan perspective, but also I need to respect their humanness and their dignity. And what's most important is not that the label is accurate necessarily and that everyone buys into it. It's more of, are we in agreement what behaviors or symptoms are of concern or are causing problems individually or in the context of a relationship? Let's work on those. And that's transformed the way that I approach diagnosing. And then especially from a family relational perspective, because we know that family systems can exacerbate a mental disorder. We also know that family systems doesn't like to look at one individual as the problem, as the sole causal factor, that there's interactional and reciprocal, you know, dynamics that are happening relationally. And a linear cause and effect doesn't really matter and fit when we're looking from a family systems perspective. And so looking at what the family might be doing that's either maintaining the behaviors that are of concern, that are the symptoms of a possible disorder, and working with that and balancing that with, if there is a legitimate diagnosis, that the family learns how to manage and support that and making sure that individual gets the proper, if necessary, medication. But medication's not always necessary just because the diagnosis is given. And I've had to educate families on that. And even severity of a diagnosis. And that's, for me, is what's been helful with especially the new DSM-5, because it places much more emphasis on obtaining a severity rating. Let me give an example, coming back to ADHD. Our culture is such that if someone gets a diagnosis of ADHD, the instant treatment recommendation is there has to be medication. That's not always correct, though, in my book. And for me, understanding severity levels of mild, moderate, severe, and accurately determining those has helped me to educate clients that if you have ADHD with a mild severity rating, I don't want you taking medication. I'm not going to recommend medication. I'm safe to say you probably will never need medication. There's some skills we can work on to manage symptoms. If clients are in the moderate range, we might need some medication. We're going to really ramp up the counseling skills that we're going to work on, the coping mechanisms and helping, but we're going to be open to the possibility of medication. It might need to be an adjunct to what we do. And that could be temporary too. It doesn't mean you have to take medication for the rest of your life. But if someone has a rating of severe or extreme, then for me, medication is essential up front in connection with counseling. But it's helped me to reconceptualize disorders, that just because a diagnosis is given doesn't mean that pharmacology has to automatically happen for clients. And I've had clients where I've counseled them to get off medications or to change medications based on their severity rating that I've determined for a particular disorder. And it's empowered them. And there's clients that haven't been on medications that need to be on medications because of the extreme severity of a disorder. That's helped me to be more individualized and not a globalized blanket approach that just because there's a diagnosis, well, we have to get medication automatically. That's not the case for clients. And I need to be very contextual, very individualized in my treatment with clients.
I appreciate how you characterize that. That, you know, diagnoses exist on a continuum, and that, you know, it's important to acknowledge that there are stigma or cultural assumptions or, you know, fallacies associated with a particular diagnosis, and how that can be problematic in the sense of it's seen as a label, but that counseling in conjunction with a diagnosis and perhaps medicine might be a better route than any just single one of those in some cases. Are there various times where, you know, you've really had to dig deeply into counseling beyond maybe the example you've already given of having to work beyond that label, where it's necessary to acknowledge the diagnosis, to explore the criteria, but part of implementing those necessary skills that need to be achieved or obtained, you had to also first, you know, work through that label?
I would think, especially when I've worked with couples, because I've had a good number of couples that will come in, and one of the partners has already diagnosed the other partner. They've gone on the internet, they've searched these websites, they've printed off this checklist, and they come in with a diagnosis like bipolar. My partner's bipolar. I've read about it. They fit all the symptoms. They're bipolar. And I've had to learn to just, you know, go with that. That may be the situation. That may be the case. It may not be. What I hear is that you're searching for answers. And you want to know what you can do to make your relationship better. That's what I want to focus on. What are the specific concerns that you have about your partner? And let's have a discussion about what your options are to how those might change. But I can't guarantee they'll change, because that's your partner's choice. And if we're going to work on this and make the relationship improve, one of the things that I've learned in working with couples is that you really have control over yourself, not so much each other. And one thing that couples get stuck in is trying to fix, change, and control their partner. And if that's going on between the two of you, that's going to be my first order of business, is to change that. So I've learned, you know, methods and ways to take in the diagnosis part, but to also then separate that and to really get down to what are the core basic issues and what's really going to be most helpful for this couple at this time right now. Because if I have someone coming in a couple's relationship who's diagnosing their partner is insisting that we focus on that label, from a family systems perspective, that raises an alarm for me, that I need to work really hard to reframe all of this to make it relationally focused, not individually focused, because that's a big part of the problem right there, is that one partner feels like they have the power in the hierarchy to determine a diagnosis, which gives the other partner a one down in the relationship. That power differential for me systemically is more concerning than whether there is a diagnosis or not. And so I want to explore that power differential more, and I want to work on equalizing that.
Are there other aspects of systemic approaches to conceptualizing and assessing particular mental illnesses or exploring a diagnosis that you'd want to discuss?
I think that, you know, exploring relational and systemic factors, communication, hierarchy, power differentials, intergenerational transmission, I think is really essential for any and all disorders in the diagnostic manual. because none of those disorders exist in isolation. They all exist in relationship. The individual who may have the diagnosis is in a relationship to parents, siblings, extended family, school teachers, school professionals, employers, and peers at work, or if they're in school or college. So the disorder is never in isolation. And so other people are impacted by the symptoms of the disorder, but also what people are doing in response to those symptoms is also impacting the expression of those symptoms or the severity manifestation of the symptoms. For example, if parents are very harsh and punitive towards a child who legitimately has his ADHD, we know that that's going to make things worse. It's not going to help with the noncompliance, and we're probably going to then get a second diagnosis coming out of this called oppositional defiant disorder, which to me is just, I reframe it as it's a parenting dysfunctional symptom. There needs to be some change in the parenting-child relationship and the disciplining approach. So I've also learned that some disorders are symptoms of dysfunctional family interactions and relationships, and that when we adjust those and balance those, that diagnostic label seems to go away, particularly a lot of the disruptive behavior disorders.
As you said, that's a way of reframing or reconceptualizing what was previously a painful reality, say for the parent of, you know, my child has this problem, and yet now the perspective is, as a parent, my behaviors and mindsets have perhaps contributed to this problem. How have you worked with parents maybe who haven't reacted well to that type of reframe?
I've reframed it back to them that you've tried the best you can with what you know and what you have available to you. So there's no malicious intent with anything that you've done. You have bent over backwards and you've done all these things because you love and care about your daughter or your son or your spouse. And I've reflected back to then the other person of, I know that you get frustrated or angry when they're trying to help you. And what I'm hearing at the same time is that all those efforts have been because they care about you. They love you. They're just trying to help you. And I understand for you, it doesn't feel like help. It doesn't seem like help. It seems like control. But I'm hearing that they're scared of losing you. Could be because of a suicide risk. Or they're scared because they don't know what to do and they see you suffering. Those have been powerful moments when I've gotten some deeper feelings and reframed behaviors, motives, and even communication styles. I find that hands down, it really transforms the perspective of my clients, and it gives them empathy for the people that are in their close relationships that they're most frustrated and angry at. And then it helps to then just tone things down and reduce the conflict and get them more engaged in the counseling process.
You're clearly like the king of the reframe. Like you give so many great examples of how you've kind of just like skillfully and almost effortlessly invited others to reframe something. And so I would love to just turn the table on you right now and invite you to share a way in which you had to step back and reflect and reframe something for yourself.
Wow, that's a powerful question. And I appreciate you kind of putting me on the spot in a sense and the here and now, because that's really what the counseling process, you know, is really about. I think for me that my doctrinal education was very demanding. It was very rigorous. It was a cake rep program as well. And, you know, I had a family too, and I had work obligations, and it was very demanding time-wise. And I've had to look back at how how stressful it was to finish my doctorate, of how it affected me, affected, you know, my wife, affected my children. And to appreciate the time and the sacrifice, you know, put into it, and some of the pain that we experienced from it because of the time that it demanded of me, that in some ways it's been an investment. And it seemed like initially some of the investments of time and energy and money weren't worth it. It caused me to question, is it really worth finishing? Am I really going to get from it what I've wanted or hoped? And for me, I look back on my completing my doctoral degree and education. Yes, it's opened up career opportunities that only could happen because of having a doctoral degree in counselor education supervision. But I look back at the process. The whole process was a learning experience for me because I learned more of who I was and who I wasn't. And it became an investment in discovering more of myself and helping me become more authentic and genuine with my own personal identity and my identity in a marriage, my identity in relationship to my children. As difficult and as stressful as it was, there's things that I experienced and things that I was taught by my faculty members that I can look back and see that it was a difficult, challenging process, especially the dissertation process, but it was an investment in me discovering who I was. And for me, in some ways, whatever job opportunities and career paths I encounter, because I have that degree, is not as important as looking back at me understanding myself more. Was probably the most valuable educational part of getting my doctoral degree. And learning patience and determination and how they pay off are more important personal attributes for me to be mindful of. So I think it's important for me to reframe what my doctoral degree really represents and what it means for me personally is more important than the actual piece of paper that's hanging on my wall.
The Reframe is a production of the International Association of Marriage and Family Counselors. If you enjoyed today's episode, please rate and review the show in Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening. Join me next month on The Reframe.